threatening with a crowd.
You are listening to Radio Free Signs of the Times, broadcasting into the heart of an occupied America.
Hi, I'm Joe Quinn, and you're listening to an all-new Signs of the Times SOT.net podcast. This is our first podcast for 2010, and it's been quite a while since our last one, but we're determined to make this year the year of the podcast here at SOT.net, so you can expect to see many more coming your way over the next few months. Today we're going to be talking about the most recent alleged terror attack in Detroit on the 25th of December 2009. This was the case of the underwear bomber, as he has come to be known. And with me in the studio to discuss the details of this very interesting event is Anne, who is a regular reader of SOT.net. So, hi Anne, and welcome.
Hello, Joe.
This case of the underwear bomber, I wrote an editorial for SOT.net on the 31st of December 2009. It was entitled "The Underwear Bomber: Crushing Freedom with Phony Arab Terrorism." And the reason I chose that title was because, having done quite a lot of research over the past several years into the war on terror in general and other very similar, at least in nature, types of terror attacks to this underwear bomber terror attack, that title summed up really what the point was, or what was behind these types of attacks. It was for the purpose of crushing freedom around the world in many different ways, and crushing the freedom of many different people, not just Arabs or Muslims, but also people in the Western world.
Absolutely. Basically, we're not dealing with terrorism, with real terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with theater and control and manipulation, period.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The whole concept of terrorism goes back a long way, although it might seem like it's a new idea. Specifically Muslim terrorism, but it's not. Muslims and Arabs have been called terrorists by Western governments for close to 100 years now. During the First World War, during and after the First World War. Winston Churchill actually has the honour of being the first British Prime Minister to use chemical weapons on a civilian population in Baghdad in 1920 against ordinary people who were revolting against British occupation at the time.
And he called the people who were beaten down the terrorists.
Yes, these people who were revolting simply because they were being unfairly and unjustly treated by an occupying power, a foreign nation. They were called terrorists, and that's been, as I say, that's been going on for almost 100 years. But recently, it's since 9/11, obviously, it has gone through the roof in terms of the amount of groups, or the number of groups that are being labelled as terrorists around the world. And people really need to think a little bit more about, and read as much as they can about, the real roots of this conflict, what's behind it, and not believe the simple black and white analyses that are given to them by the mainstream media.
But when the only thing they read is the mainstream media, when the only access they have is the televised, especially mainstream media, what else can they do? They're literally hypnotized and sleeping. With this latest little foray into terrorism land, mind control? Was it a mind control situation?
Well, mind control seems to be, although we have no smoking gun evidence that this is the case, there obviously is a history, an official history, that mind control is real under the CIA project during the 50s, 60s, 70s called MK Ultra. The CIA in the US were very interested in the possibility of being able to control a person's mind through hypnosis and
sort of a Sirhan situation.
Yeah. Drug-induced states, trance states, where a person could be...
How else do you get someone to set their own underwear on fire?
That's a very good question. I mean...
this is not something even a crazy person would do. Well, maybe, but...
Well, yeah, but if it's a crazy person, then that removes any real possibility that this person could be fighting for some...
Unless Al-Qaeda's, you know, recruiting crazy people.
Unless they're all just crazy people.
Right.
In which case, we shouldn't be fighting a war where the U.S. government commits, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops and contractors and private mercenaries to kill them. We should be sending out psychologists or mental health practitioners. Yeah. So... You asked the question, how could people possibly get a grip or get an idea of what's really going on behind the war on terrorism if they don't have any access to real information or more objective information than they get in the mainstream media? And that is a really good question, and it's a very difficult question to answer. At this stage, the best bet, as I see it, is, in fact, in the increasingly dubious nature of these terror attacks.
It's getting so ridiculous.
Yeah,
you would think somebody would, and they would start to notice how ridiculous it's getting.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that a lot of people in the U.S. are actually calling this recent quote-unquote terror attack as the crotch bomber, because that adds a little bit of ridiculousness to the situation, and therefore perhaps a little bit of disbelief can begin to creep in. And we can only hope that they continue to become more desperate. It seems that they're becoming more desperate, and we can only hope that they continue to become more desperate in terms of their attempts to sell this war on terrorism, war on Muslim terrorism, clash of civilizations to the people, because as they become more desperate, there's a greater chance that they will slip up or resort to ever more ridiculous events.
It does seem that they're becoming more desperate because it's so badly done. And either it's badly done because they had no time to plan it, or it's badly done because they're just becoming so desperate that they're not even thinking clearly. They don't even make sense.
Yeah, they don't.
It's not even vaguely logical.
Yeah.
The guy got onto a plane with no passport. Is this true?
Yeah, this is from eyewitnesses at the airport that he arrived at the gate to board the plane.
So I get a full body rub down three times before I get into line to get on the plane, and this guy walks on without a passport?
Yeah, apparently that's what happened, according to eyewitnesses. And in this situation, and it's very important to remember this, in this situation or in situations like this where you have a terror attack and there's a lot of propaganda going on around it, the best sources of information are the eyewitness reports that happen in the immediate aftermath of the event. Because there is an awful lot of evidence that the mainstream media is in the pay of government, so you're not going to get an objective or independent or unbiased.
You get the spin.
Yeah, you're going to get the government's story, the official story.
Right.
And we have every reason to suspect that the official story from the government is not true, or at best only partly true. So eyewitnesses are the best resource, really. And yeah, we have there are eyewitness reports that this particular would be terrorist at the tender age of 23 arrived at the gate in Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam in the company of a well-dressed Indian-looking man who told the attendant at the gate that the young would-be terrorist had no passport but needed to get on the plane anyway. And that really struck me as strange. You know, who walks up to the gate in an airport and says, "Hi, I don't have a passport, but I need to get this person on the plane anyway." Unless you're crazy, deluded, but that doesn't seem to be the case in this particular instance.
Because
so the guy he got on the plane. So the guy who said that, who accompanied this young Nigerian Mutalib to the gate, was obviously convinced that he was going to be able to get him on the plane, that he had authority. So this sounds like someone who believed that he had some authority, and apparently he did have some authority, to get a person on the plane without a passport. That also suggests to me that neither of these men, or at least Mutalib, who was getting on the plane, did not go through, or is unlikely to have gone through, any security checks. Because if you can walk him up to the gate after everyone has arrived and is sitting at the gate, and you can walk this guy up last and say, I need to put him on the plane, and get him on the plane without a passport, it's very likely he got him through security without any checks. He didn't come through the normal process at the airport. So that is just one of the many strange aspects of this.
Strange is an understatement. That doesn't happen. I mean, that's out of a movie.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so that point that we can reasonably establish that he didn't come through security opens up another troubling question as to why he didn't, or wasn't given by his terrorist masters, supposedly, given some kind of a bomb, if his plan was to blow up the plane,
exactly.
Give some kind of a proper bomb. I mean, if you don't go through security at an airport, if you've got some kind of special clearance and someone to escort you to the gate and put you on the plane without a passport,
you could have anything.
Surely he could put a hand grenade in his pocket, or a stick of dynamite in it. You know, I mean, something that wouldn't require this young man, Mutalib, to do what he apparently had to do.
To set his underwear on fire.
On the plane, which was to secrete a bunch of powder wrapped up in cellophane in his underwear, strapped to his crotch, basically. And then try to, later on in the flight, before it landed, to try and inject some kind of acid into this powder that was attached to his crotch, and then try to set it on fire with a match. It's just so farcical and so beyond so beyond anything that actually fits with the US government's claims about this real and dangerous terrorist threat. It sounds like a bunch of clowns.
It's a Keystone Cops terrorist unit.
Yeah. But yet and all, based on this Keystone Cops terror threat, the US government has invaded two countries and committed hundreds of thousands of troops, and the CIA has been running private military contractors and mercenaries to do their dirty work in Iraq, Afghanistan, into Pakistan more recently, and very recently into Yemen, all on the basis of this ridiculous threat.
It's a grotesque theater, and the acting is really bad.
Yeah, that's a very good way of summing it up, actually.
And if they had an intention to bring this plane down, it would have been the easiest thing in the world. The guy didn't even go through security. So it's not even a point of, let's inflict damage. Let's inflict real damage and really kill people. It's
let's inflict some more fear and mind
control.
Programming on the American and world population. And that is what is behind the war on terror, very clearly. If you look at the long series of terror alerts and terror attempts and terror attacks over the past 8-9 years since 9/11, you see that all of them, or the vast majority of them, had the effect of terrorizing essentially the US and the European population into believing in this Muslim terror threat, and therefore a clash of civilizations, which then leads to a silencing of any potential public protest or questioning of this horrible and destructive war on terror that has killed millions of people at this stage, bankrupted or almost bankrupted the US economy.
Well, I'm sure it's bankrupted. It's all
on
stilts at this point.
Uh-huh.
And even if Americans are now calling it the crotch bombing, and they're snickers and oh, I can't believe this, and this is ridiculous and silly, guess what? They're still having to sit down for the last hour of their international flights, and they're still having to get pat-downs to get on the planes.
Yeah.
And they still cannot carry on more than one carry-on. And even that has to be, a laptop or a handbag? So, you know, snicker all you like, and it's good that you're noticing that it doesn't make sense, but still the controls are being put in place, and you're being locked down more and more and more, and there's not a thing you can do about it.
No. There isn't anything people can do to stop those controls, those ridiculous, invasive, intrusive airport controls, and just the horrible nature of what is today international air travel, or even national air travel. It's not a nice experience, and it seems to be getting a lot worse. I suppose what people can do is just stop flying, but would that play into the hands? Is that
absolutely? If you limit people's mobility, you limit people's information, and that they would love that. That would be perfect. And flying of any type now, whether it's domestic or international, is just so painful,
mm-hmm.
inconvenient.
You had an experience recently, actually, when you came recently through.
My international travel was not pleasant.
Came through a European airport.
Yeah, during there was a snowstorm. That was the reason. But unfortunately, when you get trapped in a German airport in a snowstorm, you're on your own.
Yeah.
There's no help. There's a lot of security. I had full body, not a pat down.
No.
Full body rub down.
Yeah.
Four times. So there's a lot of security, but there's no help whatsoever.
The kind
no
of thing
assistance.
Some deviant people pay for.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Just kept going back. So yeah, air travel is just it's torture at this point. Well, not literally, but it's approaching that. It's uncomfortable. It's demeaning. It's a lesson in being controlled. And if you don't smile, and if you aren't pleasant, and if you aren't polite while you're being controlled, then you get pulled aside.
Yeah.
And God forbid, if you're a person of color, then you're getting pulled aside.
Mm-hmm.
If you're male and traveling by yourself and a person of color, you're getting pulled aside for longer. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's Kafka-esque. There's no way around it. There's no way to address anyone about it. There's no way to get any assistance. You are not a human being. You are
cattle. Yeah.
If not an assumed prisoner. It's just completely out of control.
It is. It's very strange the way ordinary people, and I'm assuming they're ordinary people in airports who are actually the foot soldiers in this campaign, it seems, to make international air travel a hell, basically. These are ordinary people, and a lot of people, in my own experience in traveling on airplanes over the past few years, is that a lot of these people are just simple, ordinary people, and they're just obeying the rules and regulations that have been handed down to them.
Absolutely.
And they don't even seem to see that there's anything wrong with it, and it all ties back to this terrorist threat, because that is what underpins it all. That's the reason in the back of all these airport workers, security workers' minds as to why they're doing this, because obviously they need to have some reason why they're doing it, or they might start to question it or speak out a little bit about it. But the ubiquitous terror threat keeps those questions from being expressed.
And once they buy into that, then everything else is okay. Everything serves that basis. So once they buy in to that, the truth of that, and even the passengers, once they buy into the truth of that, then they sit still and quiet. And
they're thankful for it, even some of them, yeah?
Some of them, although I think that's a small minority. From my recent experience, it was a lot of anger and a lot of resentment and a lot of hands in the air. And I don't think people are quite as stupid and oblivious as those who are putting a lot of this in motion think they are, that are.
Yeah.
But, you push people too far and you give people nothing left to lose, and they are going to notice at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of them.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, we definitely will see. And the way it's been going in the past few years, it can only get worse. It's on a downward track, and it's going to keep going. But yes, we mentioned the idea that this latest terror attack, the underwear bomber, that it was for the purpose of keeping the population, largely the world population, in fact, but particularly the US and European populations, on message, mm-hmm. and on track with this idea of the war on terror, that there is an Arab or Islamic terrorist threat to the free peoples of the world, blah, 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 blah.
So we can't pull our troops out.
Yes. Yeah, so
we can't close Guantanamo, because look at what happened.
Well, exactly, yeah. That's the point that probably most important and one of the central reasons for this recent event. You had Obama in 2007 making his promise that if by the time he was elected president, the troops had not been removed or brought home from Iraq and Afghanistan, that he would make sure it happened, and he said, take that to the bank. Mm-hmm. You can take that to the bank. He's duly elected president, and he reneges on his promises. He also promised that he would close down Guantanamo. He said all the right things for...
Oh, he signed the papers.
Yeah.
1 year. Why it would take a year, I'm not sure. But, yeah, 1 year, we'll close down Guantanamo.
He obviously made all these promises because he realized that this was what was on the minds of a majority of American voters, that they wanted the war to end. They didn't agree with the war. They realized it was perhaps an unjust or just a useless war. Guantanamo was
even at the most base level, even if they didn't understand it's unjust, or even if they didn't even think far enough to say, what are we doing there? Why are we killing all these people for no reason? Even at the most base level, their kids, brothers and cousins are going off and coming back broken.
Yeah.
Psychologically, emotionally, mentally, if they're normal. They're broke. You know, these people have lost jobs who are still in the U.S. The economy's going to hell.
Yeah. And people realize that
their lives are not good.
And that a war is the last thing you need. Trillions of dollars on a war is the wrong thing to do. So this was the prevailing sentiment at the time, leading up to the 2008 election. Obama and his people realized this, so they pandered to those needs, desires of the American people. They promised these things, close Guantanamo, end the war, because obviously Guantanamo, America had received such bad international press.
Yeah, you know what makes us look bad when we torture people in the open like that?
Yeah.
We can torture them in our CIA secret prisons because no one really notices.
Yeah.
But you know, we can't be caught with our knickers down torturing people in Guantanamo in front of God and everybody. And
so he promised to close down Guantanamo, and then he doesn't. And so there, in the past year, in his first year as president, his initial soaring popularity has taken a bit of a nosedive. Mm-hmm. Based on his broken promises. So right at Christmas in his first year, we have a terror attack that reaffirms the need to keep the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan and indeed expand the war on terror to a new country, Yemen. That deals with that grievance among the American population. If any of them were thinking, well, he broke his promise, well, what about the terror attack? What about the terror threat? We have to keep the troops there because here's evidence, and it's right in Detroit. And answering the Guantanamo question, why he didn't close it down when he said it he would, well, it was coincidentally revealed that by parties unknown within the intel agencies that the two people who trained this underwear bomber and give him his materials and schooled him in the ancient art of hiding underwear a bomb in your knickers were two men who had been in Guantanamo and had been released to Saudi Arabians who had been released from Guantanamo a couple of years ago. And right there you've got evidence as to why we need Guantanamo. Those guys, not only should you not close down Guantanamo, but you got to keep these guys in Guantanamo because look what happens. You let them out. They go. They find some impressionable young guy in some far off country, and he comes to America and he tries to blow up a plane. I mean, it makes sense, right? It's a wonderful narrative. It convinces me.
It's the worst soap opera I've ever watched. It's astounding. The overriding sentiment in the part of the country I'm from, the U.S., with Obama, it's a fairly liberal area that I'm currently living in, and the overriding sentiment there is, he means well. Give him time. There is so much reluctance to look at what's really going on because that's too negative. They cannot look that direction. That it's just, oh, well, he's trying. Well, you can't just go in and change everything right away. Well, he keeps trying. You know,
they're looking into an abyss, though. If they do look at that, then they're... What else is there for them to look to? There's nothing left. Yeah. Obama is this great hope. He after Bush, he was meant to change it all around. And if he turns out to be just the same or even worse, if that were possible, then I can't imagine the kind of despair that people would feel,
exactly,
especially in the U.S. They have nowhere else to turn.
So he pretty much can do what he wants to do because there will always be that segment of the population, a fairly large segment, that will give him the benefit of the doubt until it's impossible to do so any longer. By then, it's too late.
Well, it certainly
I mean, you know, you
not looking good.
Yeah, you have the others as well who just despise him. But, you know, those are usually the really far right wing fundamentalists who despise him for, you know, no matter what he did or what he said.
Yeah.
Despise him anyway.
Like the Alex Jones crowd.
Right.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually, because I know Alex Jones and his adepts or his acolytes or his supporters, whatever you want to call them, all the people on his groupies, yeah, all the people on his forum and his website that just love to tune in. I know that they all ostensibly are against Obama mainly because of his health reform. Sorry, Bill and his attempt to pass what they call a socialism within the U.S. make America a socialist country. God forbid. But
those are the type of people who are so easily led that it's comical if it weren't so tragic.
Yeah, it's a bit tragic.
They're given false definitions and fed the false definitions, and then everything's based on that. And
when you mention that there are people in the U.S., the far right, who right from the beginning were not going to be happy with Obama, and I'm assuming you're suggesting here that it's based on his color. It's a racism.
But and the idea that he's a liberal, which he could not be farther from a liberal if he tried. But yeah, the color and the
I'm not trying to lump Alex Jones in with them, but I'm just wondering about the extent of the anti-Obama coverage that Alex Jones has been giving since the very beginning. I'm wondering if that healthcare reform can be all that is behind that vitriol, because...
Oh, I doubt it. I mean, there are enough objective reasons to be critical of Barack Obama as president based on his policies and his actions since he's been elected. There's more than enough material there to be critical of him as in that office. But what is fascinating is the emotional material that's used to send people into frenzies, just these frenzies of hatred, mm-hmm. with the emotional material that they get from people like Jones, which is barely, if often at all, based on fact. You know, it's all emotion. It's all this word socialism with, you know, not to be demeaning, but most of those people don't even understand the definition and how that would apply in this case because, you know, it's just words and emotions. And it's the oldest trick in the book, you know. Yeah. Rile people up with hatred and emotion and hot buttons that really aren't linked to reality at all, and set them loose.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually reading a story just the other day about segregation in U.S. schools between blacks and whites. And today, as of 2009, as of last year, it's actually worse than it was 40 years ago. Segregation in the U.S. is worse than it was during the whole civil rights.
Is it because it's basically economic segregation is what has happened?
It's probably largely, but I think there's a hidden segregation. I think that the integration that supposedly happened in the latter half of the 20th century in the U.S. was not all it was cracked up to be, or not. It wasn't exactly the way it was spun in the media. It wasn't all hunky dory, you know. And that a lot of the racism, underlying racism, didn't go away.
Because you can't legislate away racism. It's impossible. I mean, I grew up in the Southeast and went to a grammar school that had just recently been integrated. And, you know, there was the white water fountain and the colored water fountain with signs over each one. I mean, it's a bizarre mindset, and you can't legislate away that kind of emotional thinking and hatred. I mean, across the board, I think it was successful in a lot of ways, but you're talking about human beings. And not to bash America, I mean, there are a lot of brilliant, amazing people in this country, but it's a very insular country. And when a country is that isolated, it makes it much, much harder for people to open their minds. It's an incredibly isolated, you know, mentally and culturally. If most kids growing up in America think that America is the only country on the planet for the most mm-hmm. part, you know, until they get a little older, and it's just...
And that's by design. Yeah. It must be.
Exactly, because then how do you feel guilty about taking from everyone else on the planet so you can have your SUV? You know?
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, it's fairly well known. It's almost a cliche about Americans not really knowing a lot about the rest of the world, and it has to be by design, as we just said, because we're talking about education and education policy on the part of successive American governments in terms of educating the population about the rest of the world. And there's definitely, I mean, you know, obviously better from coming from the US than I do, about the way that is presented to kids in school, about how their awareness of the rest of the world and even what happens in terms of history.
Yeah, it's indoctrination. I mean, the fact of the matter is the vast majority, from my perspective, of Americans, if they honestly knew, if they had any idea whatsoever the extent of what their government does around the world and what actions we take to control and destroy other parts of the world, they would not accept it, and they would put a stop to it, and that's the point. They can't know that. They can't know that, or it would stop. Because, you know, the Americans are not evil people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These are people with good hearts, and they just don't know. They're kept ignorant. They're kept ignorant, and if they had any idea.
Yeah, and it's not just about not educating people, because, I mean, most governments tend not to want to educate their populations about the less attractive aspects of history of that country. But, yeah, exactly. You don't want people to be too smart either. But in the U.S., it seems that part of that is also to somehow prevent people from traveling to other countries or wanting to travel to other countries or knowing that there are other countries to travel to or knowing the truth about them. Because I suppose if people were to even travel widely to other parts of the world, they would see for themselves certain things. They would get exposed to other viewpoints, etc. So
exactly.
Not only do they not want to teach the population even a tiny amount about the true history of the U.S. and its true, you know, military and imperial history, but they don't want people going off to find out for themselves either.
Well, exactly, and that goes back to limiting, making travel really, really inconvenient and unpleasant.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think, one of the reasons for this most recent terror attack, as we've noted. It's making, or seems to be, that the plan is to make air travel much more painful, and just to stop people wanting to do it. But as has always been the case in terms of these phony terror attacks, there are several agendas achieved at the same time. I mean, they don't want to waste it. It's an opportunity, so they...
Right, so it can push forward, you know, further warmongering.
Yeah.
And here I was thinking that having to carry on my lotion in a little quart-sized plastic bag was as bad as it could get.
Yeah. Apparently not.
No.
So I just wanted to get back to the story of the underwear bomber. Initially, reports in the news about the event, about what happened, really left us with not a lot to go on. We just had some young Nigerian guy who seemed to be in a trance, which was what an eyewitness, the guy actually who...
Yeah, that was actually what on the airplane who used.
Yeah, who tackled him on the airplane, said that he seemed to be in a trance. He was totally docile. And so we had this young guy attempting to set off this bomb that really was never going to work.
That couldn't, yeah.
And it could have been just some crazy person, I mean. But very quickly afterwards, a stream of information, really unreasonably quickly, a stream of information came out from intelligence sources within the U.S.,
all sorts of handy facts just popping up.
Yeah. One of them being Intel Center, which is this semi-private intelligence gathering operation, which is staffed by ex-military, ex-CIA members. It's really kind of outsourcing intelligence, or it's an organization to keep the intelligence gathering and the providing of intelligence data on terrorism one step away from the U.S. government or from the CIA, although that's really where it's just Intel Center is just the CIA by another name. So Intel Center produces very quickly a picture.
Literally.
Yeah, produces perhaps literally a picture of the bomber, Mutalib, with a flag in the background, which is according to the name, the flag of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So this was immediately then evidence that linked Mutalib and the whole attempted bombing.
Don't you have pictures of yourself in front of the flags of the different organizations you're a member of?
Of course.
I think that's pretty usual.
Yeah.
I think.
So this was suspicious, to say the least, at least from our point of view, given our research into these kind of operations. So we did a bit of research, and we found that video from 2006 that was also released by Intel Center of the alleged Al-Qaeda number 2, Ayman al-Zawahiri, that a video that was allegedly released by Al-Qaeda showing this Al-Qaeda number 2 giving this typical speech of, you know, I'm going to kill all the infidels.
So Intel Center
released this video as well
video,
in 2006.
But the video itself was supposedly made by Al-Qaeda, correct?
Yes, well,
he is the
star of the video was Al-Qaeda.
Okay,
so always, and they always find these on jihadist websites.
Course,
they don't say which websites. There and internet postings on jihadist websites saying, we did such and such terror attack, we're going to kill all your infidels, slaughter you, you know, chop you up and feed you to, etc. So this video from 2006 of the Al-Qaeda number 2, which was found by Intel Center and posted on their website and given to the media outlets to disseminate around the world. A guy, computer kind of whiz kid kind of guy, who had developed a program that could analyze videos and images and look at what they call the metadata behind the video and the layers. If, for example, it had been tweaked or manipulated via Photoshop or another photo editing program,
he could see
all of that data.
Gotcha.
And so he analyzed a still from the video of this Al-Qaeda number 2, and he found that the video came with, when it was released, came with the logo of Intel Center up in the right-hand corner, just the words Intel Center, marking it as coming from them, that they were branding it. Yeah.
Right. Like CNN or Fox News.
So it showed the Al-Qaeda number 2 guy sitting in front of a backdrop of a cloth with writing on it, which was supposedly...
Like a banner?
Yeah, a banner that was declaring it as authentically Al-Qaeda. But this guy, computer guy, who was able to prove with the software that he developed that the background writing on the cloth behind the Al-Qaeda number 2 was added to the video. That it wasn't there in the original filming of the video, that it was added afterwards, but that the most interesting part, obviously, is that it was added at the same time as the Intel Center logo. So you basically had a video of this guy who, for some reason, when I look at him, he always reminds me of Mr. Magoo. You know, the cartoon of Mr. Magoo. It's the glasses and the kind of bumblingness of him. Yeah. He's like Mr. Magoo with a beard and a turban.
And a turban.
This video was... Of dubious origin. It's hard to tell when you look at the video or look at the image from the video. It really does look like it's been thrown together and photoshopped many times.
But he actually found the data that proves that the banner behind the head, the banner that identifies the man as Al-Qaeda,
yes,
was placed into this video at the same time as
Intel Center. Yes. So somebody who put the Intel Center logo on there.
Video.
Yeah. Whoever put the Intel Center on, which is supposedly Intel Center people,
right,
who are ex and probably current U.S. military and CIA, had also put together the video, essentially. They had manufactured, at least to some degree, the video. But they say that this video was found by them on a jihadist website and was produced by Al-Qaeda. So if you follow the logic, they're saying that they're Al-Qaeda.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because it was produced by Al-Qaeda. So we take them at their word. They're saying we are.
Yeah. So that was another red flag.
So in a sane world, that information that you just relayed here would be on CBS Evening News, NBC
yes.
Evening News, maybe not in Fox. But,
no, it's not, obviously. And the many other details, the confusing, strange, unbelievable details of the official story of the underwear bomber, do not appear on any of the main evening news programs. What does appear and what is being parroted endlessly on these programs is that this was Al-Qaeda This guy was an Al-Qaeda operative. He was given the bomb and trained to do to carry out his attack by two Saudi Arabian former Guantanamo inmates, but that he had spent 6 months from August or July or August last year until December, just before his misguided attack in Yemen. So the story was much simplified from these strange details that we are talking about here to a very simple, this guy wanted to kill Americans because they were
because
Afghanistan and because they're Americans, and that he has direct links to Yemen. And the interesting thing, obviously, is that Yemen was the subject of several bombing raids by the Yemeni government just in the last couple of weeks, which killed many innocent civilians. And there is quite a lot of evidence that the US was either supplying, they were either US warplanes that were being flown by Yemeni pilots, or it was actually the US pilots and warplanes themselves that
so
carried out the attacks.
We had already entered the Yemeni theater.
Yes.
And so after
just
we're in there killing, either directly or via supplying, you know, the means, then we say, oh, we need to knock on the door. We're sorry. We'll make our ties here with the underwear bomber, and then it's okay, we're here.
Yeah, after the fact. So it's just the expansion of the war on terror to another country, another Arab country. One of the main reasons for the entire war on terror, and this is only one of the reasons, because it's very likely that there are several different agendas being served by the phony war on terror. But Yemen is a very strategic in terms of its location.
It
sits right on the south of the Arabian Peninsula, right below Saudi Arabia, and you have access to the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean and all of those major kind of strategic oil producing nations on North East Africa. Somalia, Sudan, which the US have been heavily involved over the past 10, 20 years as well. And also Yemen itself is an oil-producing nation and a gas-producing nation. And recently, several contracts for the exploration and production of oil, of Yemeni oil, were signed by, guess what, ExxonMobil, BP,
Total.
Yes. So you have these big international oil companies with serious vested interests, financial interests in Yemen, which obviously links back to the US government and British government and the French government. And you put all that together and you start to get an idea of what this is all about.
But really, we were already there. And it was already happening. So it's like this ball, this Christmas ball of joy that, okay, now we have a concrete reason. We've been there, but now we have our concrete ties, so no one can question. Plus, we get to put more controls on the populace.
Exactly, and more controls not only on the US and European populations, but also on the Middle Eastern populations, because obviously Middle Eastern people, despite how they have been and are portrayed in the mainstream media as something close to backward howling savages type people, they are well aware of the injustices of occupation by a foreign power and the exploitation of the natural resources that are all shipped overseas and to the West while they live in relative poverty. So, like any normal people, they're not happy about that set of circumstances. And in Yemen, there has been, over the past quite a few years, there's been several grassroots groups that have been clamoring for basic things, basic needs, civil rights, education, better roads, better schools, in some cases a school instead of no schools. And the Yemeni government is very closely affiliated, closely tied to the US. They basically seem to have thrown their lot in with the US and the Western powers.
Was that another CIA overthrow of a government? Was that another situation where we came in and...
No, but in the 1870s, it became a part of Yemen, became a part of the British Empire. For a while after that, it was northern Yemen was part of the Ottoman Empire. Then it most of the country was more or less under British rule right up until 1962-63. Yeah. And the British left. When the British leave countries, when the British left many of their former empires, they left physically. They pulled out right. their troops, and but they left in place.
Which and in the case of Yemen, does, right?
Yeah. And in the case of Yemen, you had petty sultans and emirs who had historically been kind of corrupt, and the ruling overlords who didn't really leave. They maintained a lot of control in terms of control of the government for over the 70s and 80s. Certain individuals that were deemed to be favourable to the geostrategic interests of the US and Britain, for example, would have been supported and were supported financially, covertly, militarily by the West, so that they rose to power. So you don't need to occupy governments, and the US government, the British government, haven't needed to occupy countries like they did in the past physically. They can occupy it covertly, right. essentially. And that's the case in Yemen. And so the Yemen people have, for a long time, the tribesmen and the various populations, the different tribal populations within Yemen, have really never known real justice or democracy or right. equal rights. And there's been a lot of conflict in Yemen over the years, but and that has always been the source of it, and it's never been, when it could have been, it's never been addressed either by the Yemeni government at the time or by way of pressure or influence being exerted by the by Western or other countries or even Arab states to pressure the government to do what they should do, what any government should do, which is treat their people fairly. Because there were always other interests that took precedence, and those interests always have been about enriching the kind of 1% at the top at the expense of the rest of the population.
So this handy little play has addressed that as well.
Exactly. Yes, it's because recently, definitely, there have been a lot of has been a lot of unrest in the north of Yemen, and attempts even by groups in the north to secede from the south, because many years ago Yemen was split into north and south, to semi-autonomous kind of states. And recently there's been a secessionist drive by the north to break away and re-establish themselves as an independent. And obviously the Yemen government doesn't want that to happen, and US and British, etc., interests in that region do not want that to happen, because, you know, right. you start... If you don't control it, you don't control the people, you don't control any government that would spring up out of those people, and therefore you don't control the natural resources. So it's not somewhere it's they want to go. So they yeah. So when it's not somewhere, when it's not something you want to happen in a country, if it doesn't play into your strategic interests, well then your first and best card these days is the terrorism card.
Because it opens the door very widely
to bombing and killing off right. the people who are threatening to get in the way.
So speaking of financial support, who is this kid's father? The underwear bomber. What was?
Yeah,
I saw something mentioned, and I didn't have time to.
Yeah, up until now, any of the quote unquote terrorists, or the majority of the terrorists that have been involved in attacks, have all been fairly, you know, normal individuals, or from people from poor backgrounds that supposedly were easily influenced or easily joined these radical groups, etc. But this young guy, Mutalib, was not of that social status at all. He was in fact the son, he is, I should say, the son of a Nigerian, former Nigerian government minister and high-level banker, who was a member of international banking institutions in Europe and the US.
So was he aware of what his son was into? Or who his son was being... Well,
that's kind of open to speculation, because once you take a person like that of that level, it's hard to know what kind of contact the father
right.
had, or what and who he was involved in. There are reports that he, at the beginning of December, walked into the US embassy in Nigeria and supposedly spoke to one of the embassy staff, i.e. CIA
right.
members, and told them that his son had become radicalized, and that he was afraid that he might be going to do something crazy, like try to blow up a plane with his underpants.
That sounds
well, he didn't say that.
That sounds like a bit of a CYA operation, wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
So he's making a public statement to
make sure
distance
that,
himself.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like he knew very well what was happening. It may have been beyond his control. But when you get into that level, or down to that level of the operation, it's hard to know exactly what was going on. You can only speculate. But that bit of evidence suggests that this guy was not your average father who just had lost track of his son. He would have known a lot more than the average person about what was going on. He was also, as I mentioned, he was an important banker in Nigeria and a government minister, and he was also head of the Nigerian arms industry. So,
oh really?
He wasn't your average citizen, let's just say. But he the only other interesting, well, there's a couple of other interesting things about Nigeria and about this in this particular story. There's back in 2008, there was a story in the in a Nigerian newspaper called the Daily Trust, where government ministers were debating the pros and cons of having the Israeli Mossad come and train Nigerian security forces and there was a voice against and voices for, and I assume.
You know, I'm shocked that the story would actually lead to the Mossad. It's just so
out of left field. Yes, there were voices for and against this proposed acceptance of a Mossad generous offer to come and train their security forces, and you know, just get to know what was going on in Nigeria and how they operated their security, and you know, maybe who the members of the elite were, and maybe if they could had a son that was impressionable or something, who could be mind programmed to blow up his underpants. That's all speculation, but
it may be
what they were. What they were planning or what they wanted to get involved in, or maybe they just wanted to help out the Nigerian security forces. But
because they're very friendly that way.
They are. They're very good that way. But in the report, the chairman of the Senate Committee on National Security and Intelligence, this is in Nigeria, said that he supported the alleged security pact with Israel. And he said, they, the Mossad, are professionals and they're here to help train our own intelligence agents. He said, I don't see any way by which their presence in the country pose any threat to our national security. I vote that as, it's from 2008, as the, do Time magazine have like the most deluded statement of the year? Because if they do, that's a candidate.
He may have had financial motivation for making such a statement.
Yeah, he may
because
well have
no
done.
One in their right mind would make that statement.
You would think so, but maybe some people don't really know an awful lot about how these things operate, because
that's
you know
true.
There isn't a lot of people doing the kind of research that we're doing, and I mean I think there are a lot of useful idiots out there, you know. But if in an imaginary world I had been sitting in the Nigerian,
would laughter have been heard
in the Nigerian parliament at that time and heard that statement, I would simply have responded to the man in question, saying that having Mossad come in and you know, infiltrate your security apparatus and get to know all about it was not a national security risk for your country. I would simply have quoted a story from the same year, actually, in the from the BBC News from 2008, which the headline of which read, "Yemen seizes Israeli-linked cell," and it was a story that the security forces in Yemen had arrested a group of alleged Islamist militants who were, surprisingly, linked to Israeli intelligence, i.e. Mossad. And the arrests were connected, the arrests of the Israeli-linked cell were connected with an attack on the US embassy in Sana'a, which is in Yemen, the previous month, which killed at least 18 people.
So Israel was pushing for this Yemen connection, as they do, as is their way, with, you know, false flag. Look at us, we're Islamic militants.
Yeah.
Wearing yarmulkes. Don't look at the yarmulke. Islamic.
But it's, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that article is a good example of why it's probably a good idea for any government ministers to not allow the Mossad to cooperate with your security forces. Because if you do, don't complain if a couple of years down the line you find that your country is being subjected to Islamic terrorists, that's in quotes, by the way, who are blowing up parts, you know, various buildings within your country, you know, and don't be surprised then afterwards if you find that they are linked to said Mossad organization that you invited into your country a couple of years previously.
It is incredibly difficult to wrap my mind around the fact that people at that level of government in any country at this point in time would not be aware of how that works with Mossad. It's astounding to me at this point in time.
Yeah.
How many years of being caught and being implicated does it take? Or maybe money blurs all those lines.
Maybe, and maybe wishful thinking blurs it all. Maybe there's a middle ground where people of that level within governments are well aware that it happens in other countries, that the Mossad has done this in other countries, but they won't do it here. Why would they do it here? There's no reason for them to do it here. But to think that way is to try to know the mind of the Mossad, and you don't want to do that, you know? Okay, so I think we'll wrap it up there. I think we've covered the topic more or less sufficiently enough to give people a different slant on what the recent underwear bombing attack in Detroit was really all about. I'd just like to thank Anne for being with us here today and
thank
for
you.
Her insights. And I'd also like to thank our listeners for tuning in. And we hope to be back with another Signs of the Times, SOT.net podcast very soon. No more lies.